Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls paper, The Courier, for Thursday, August 4th, 2022. I'm your reader, Mary Dove. Our weather today, listeners, is sunny with a high of 85 and a low of 62. Right now it's 75 and feels like 75 out there. Our relative humidity is 66%, so I hope you can get out and enjoy the day. And today is August 4th, the 216th day of 2022. There are 149 days left in our year. A highlight of today, in 1944, 15-year-old Anne Frank was arrested with her sister, parents, and four others by the Gestapo after hiding for 2 years inside a building in Amsterdam. Anne and her sister, Margit, died at the Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. Well, listeners, if August 4th happens to be your birthday, you share it with actor Tina Cole, my three sons, who is 79. Richard Blesner from Law and Order is 78. Lauren Tom from the Joy Luck Club and Men in Trees is 63. Crystal Chappelle is 57. Actor Daniel Dae Kim from Hawaii Five-O is 54. Rapper Yo-Yo is 51. Singer and actor Marcus Houston of Immature is 41. American Idol runner-up Crystal Borsak is 37. And actors Dylan and Cole Spruce from The Sweet Life of Zach and Cody are 30. All right, let's turn our attention to the front page of today's Waterloo Courier. Ernst switches vets bill vote. Theme park counters critics look to next year. Mural latest youth art project and Evansdale to amend police contract. We'll start with our lead story. Ernst switches vets bill vote. Expanded benefits get senator support after she blocked legislation, by journalist Tom Barton, Courier, Des Moines Bureau. Facing increasing pressure from Democrats and veterans advocacy organizations, the U.S. Senate passed a bill late Tuesday expanding health care and disability benefits for millions of veterans exposed to toxic burn pits. The Senate passed the measure, 86 to 11, with Iowa Republican U.S. Senator Joni Ernst and Chuck Grassley voting in favor. Ernst, a combat veteran, had previously objected with some of the other Republicans to a budget provision in the bill, which briefly blocked its passage. Democrat President Joe Biden has pushed for the legislation and is expected to sign the bill into law. Tuesday's vote ended a brief stalemate when the process derailed after Ernst and other Senate Republicans made it a late attempt last week to change a budget provision in the bill and blocked it from advancing, infuriating veterans advocacy groups. A key voting block in the November midterm elections, advocacy groups ramped up the political pressure over the last 5 days on GOP lawmakers to act. The Honoring Our Pact Act first passed the Senate in June, 84-14, and by a 342-88 vote in the House. But technical corrections sent the measure back to the Senate for another procedural vote on July 27th. 25 Republicans who supported the previous version of the bill, including Ernst, changed their votes over how the government accounts for spending slated for veteran programs. The bill is projected to increase federal deficits by about $277 billion over 10 years and does not include offsetting spending cuts or tax increases. When the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office scored the bill, it projected that nearly $400 billion slated to be spent on health services would move from discretionary spending to mandatory spending. The Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, a nonpartisan fiscal watchdog, said a reclassification of the $390 billion from discretionary to mandatory would both reduce the pressure to keep those costs under control and make it easier for appropriators to spend more elsewhere in the budget without offsets. Those dynamics, however, also applied to the bill when Senate Republicans had overwhelmingly approved the measure in June. But more than two dozen Republicans who voted for the bill in June voted this time against advancing the measure, raising questions about why Republicans block a do-over to pass the bill. Ernst blamed Democrats for not allowing the chance to offer amendments to strengthen the bill and sided with Republican Senator U.S. Senator Pat Toomey, who sought a vote on an amendment he said would not reduce spending on veterans but would limit the ability of Congress to increase spending on unrelated non-defense programs down the road. The amendment, which Ernst supported, would have kept the $400 billion in spending in the discretionary budget. Senate Republicans claim doing so will save Americans sufficient cost in the long run without sacrificing a dollar for veterans. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer struck a deal Tuesday with Republicans to let the Senate vote on the Toomey Amendment as well as two others, with 60 votes needed for passage, the same number that was needed to advance the bill itself. After voting for the Toomey Amendment, which failed, Ernst voted with Grassley and others Tuesday to pass the PACT Act. Our veterans, who have sacrificed so much and continue to pay the price for service, deserve the life-saving benefits in this bill, Ernst said in a statement. The PACT Act works to fulfill our duty to care for those who put on the uniform in the name of protecting our freedom, both past and present. Grassley has consistently supported the PACT Act and voted in favor of advancing the bill last week. Veterans who served in the post-September 11, 2001 era and were exposed to toxic burn pits will get 10 years rather than 5 of enhanced health coverage through the Department of Veterans Affairs upon their separation from the military. The PACT Act also adds 23 illnesses to the VA's list of toxic exposures-related ailments, presumed to be connected to military service, ending the need for veterans with those conditions to prove to the VA their illnesses were linked to their deployments. And it would expand care for veterans who were exposed to Agent Orange during the Vietnam War. Since 9/11, over 3.5 million veterans have suffered from toxic exposure, and many more have faced other adverse health effects from their selfless service, Grassley said in a statement. The bipartisan Honoring Our PACT Act is a critical investment in our veterans who deserve the best care possible. By making much-needed improvements to the VA, including strengthening its workforce and healthcare facilities, this bill will help ensure veterans who have sacrificed so much to defend freedom, peace, and prosperity will be well taken care of. We promise to care for our military men and women who sacrifice for our freedom. This bill helps to keep that promise. Our next headline, on the front page of August 4th, Courier, theme park counters critics' looks to next year. Challenges Addressed in Talk on Lost Island by journalist Maria Cooper. Waterloo. As Lost Island's first season is in its final month, the theme park's general manager is working to address public feedback. Eric Birch was the speaker Wednesday for this month's Windows on Waterloo, an educational series about what's happening in the city organized by the Waterloo Community Foundation. Lost Island Theme Park opening date was June 18th, a week later than expected due to the supply chain shortages and a shortage of labor. The park season ends August 28th, according to the website. Birch said most feedback he's heard has been positive, but criticism on social media sites like Facebook have made the rounds across the community. One frequent comment is that many rides weren't operating when people visited the park. Birch said all but two rides have been operational since the beginning of July, the launch coaster and the flume ride. The launch coaster's delay is due to supply chain issues. The Flume Ride's opening has been delayed by a March fire. The launch coaster would open by the last week of the season. The Flume Ride will open next year. We are bombarded with information so much, and people are going to hear what they want, Birch said. There will always be people who can't change their mind. We continue to push out the message that the rides are running and hope the misconceptions die out before next season. Birch admitted he and his team made some mistakes on how they marketed the park's opening. He didn't want to advertise the park as fully ready and then have people show up and be disappointed. We were very careful to temper that and we probably went overboard the wrong way, Birch said. This year is a year of learning. Both the public and Birch's team recognized that the number of visitors is not what was expected. Birch said he thought attendance would be similar to Lost Island's water park numbers. And it continues. In 2001, making a profit its opening year, Birch said the world is very different than it was 20 years ago, with a pandemic, high construction costs, and a bottlenecked supply chain. He said the park has broke even one day so far this season. However, it is able to survive a season of losses, and he hopes to double attendance next year. Other comments making the rounds criticize the lack of shade and the cost of parking. Lost Island Water Park doesn't charge for parking. The theme park charges $10, Birch said. The reason is the water park's lot is small, and the cost of parking at the theme park could incentivize people to carpool to take up less space. This triggered discussions of a shuttle. The park offer a park hopper pass between the theme and water parks, but they are about a half mile apart. The challenge is that the water park doesn't charge for parking, while the theme park does. In order to provide a shuttle, the water park would have to charge for parking too. As for lack of shade, Birch said trees have been planted at the theme park and they are still growing, but a lack of rain and high temperatures have delayed progress. He asked people to be patient. All right, our next headline on the front page of Thursday's Courier, Mural, Latest Youth Art Project. This story is accompanied by a colorful picture. The caption reads, Youth Art Team Member Nayara Miles does touch-up work on the Grout Museum murals. Upwards of 1,400 students use these classrooms between September and May and will see their art. By journalist Donald A. Prominski, Waterloo. The classrooms of the Grout Museum got a makeover, courtesy of the youth art team, and they have even more projects for the community right around the corner. On Wednesdays, members of the youth art team provided the finishing touches on a set of murals they painted in the rooms. The week before, a team taking part in the organization's summer camp undertook the mural project, covering the walls with representatives of the different exhibits of the museum, spanning from Native American culture to industry and the stars in the planetarium. According to Heidi Fuchman, executive and creative director of the youth art team, the decision to do the Grout Museum was made in part by their older students. They helped decide what projects we do, and then when we do the projects, they're making decisions about what we're, and it's continued on to the next page, representing in the artwork. Fuchman said, all of these decisions about what you see in these murals were made by the students. The classrooms themselves are heavily used by the museum's school students. According to Carson Morrissey, programming and outreach director at the museum, this amounts the entire third grade class at the Waterloo Cedar Falls area or upwards of 1,400 students between September and May. The students who worked on the murals were in the classes themselves at that age. The exhibits they chose to represent were drawn from their own memories of those displays that stuck with them the most growing up. They also were allowed to go through the museum itself to gather ideas. One artist, Nia Miles, found her inspiration in the railroad tracks, which were incorporated into one of the rooms. I think the railroad shows where people started, how black people and white people were separated and what they do today and what they did back then. It shows our progress as a community, Miles said. Miles added that it's her hope that the students will not only see the art, but be inspired to make their own part of the community. I think when the kids start museum school, the murals will show them what they do in the future, she said. But the youth art team also has other major projects on the docket. This week, it was announced that they had been chosen for a $10,000 grant, courtesy of the Iowa Department of Cultural Affairs, for the upcoming Vision Project. The idea behind this project is that the youth art team to get together with artists who are blind and visually impaired to learn how they go about the creative process and the tools they use. They will then put together kits to help students with visually impairments create. Having just found out about the grant, Fuchman says they are still in the planning stages of the Vision Project and what it will fully entail. Good luck to all the artists. Our last headline on the front page of the Courier, Evansdale to amend police contract. Council agrees to raise after discussing need, by journalist Andy Malone. Evansdale. After the City Council discussed the police department's current Teamsters union contract Tuesday, Mayor Deanne Klobuchar said elected officials have agreed on a pay bump for officers. She expects the August 16th meeting to include a contract amendment for the council to formally consider and approve. The $22.84 base rate would go up $2.16, or about 9%, to $25 per hour. That hike, she said, will apply across the board to other pay scale steps in an officer's second, third, fourth, fifth, eighth, 10th, 12th, and 15th year. Those years will remain the same, despite one of the previous proposals having the scale top out at the 10th. Additionally, Klobuchar said the council agreed to offer 1,500 and 2,000 bonuses after their first, second, and third year, respectively, once they complete their in-house police training. In addition to other minor incentives, another perk will be a lateral transfer clause. That means an officer coming from a different department would carry their years of service over and apply it to the Evansdale pay scale. Police Chief Mike Dean made it clear last month, leading up to this latest development, that the council needed to do a better job attracting candidates for positions in his department, or else it would risk not having a 24/7 department because of not having enough officers to work the streets. Councilors have discussed bringing about changes in recruitment across all city departments and having struggled to attract viable candidates to fill its city clerk position. Before settling on a $25 per hour base, the previous proposal had officers starting at $26 per hour, and then guaranteeing officers reach 3% salary hikes each of their first 3 years, and then 4% the fourth, fifth, eighth, 10th years. Instead, council agreed with 3% across the board until the 15th year. All right, now let's turn our attention to some Cedar Valley news. Seussical opening today at the Oster Regent. Cat in the Hat stars in musical mashup of multiple Seuss classics by journalist Melody Parker. Cedar Falls, the Cat in the Hat is the narrator, chief mischief maker, and devil's advocate in the Cedar Falls Community Theater production of Seussical the Musical, opening Thursday. Hannah Batterson, 17, is cast as Cat in the Hat, who is mischievous, never malicious or mean. I want to find the good in the cat, and that's why getting to unpack this character has been so much fun, she said. Placing the distinctive tall red and white hat on her head, she instantly felt in character. I thought, I get this. I get the cat's sense of mischief. The curtain rises at 7 p.m. Thursday at the Oster Regent Theater, 103 Main Street. Additional performances are 7 p.m. Friday and Saturday and 2 p.m. on Sunday. Seussical the Musical, with books and lyrics by Lynn Ahrens and music by Stephen Flattery, is based on the Seuss's books, particularly Horton Hears a Who, Horton Hatches an Egg, and Miss Gertrude's McFuzz. Director Kyle Weber said the musical comedy will appeal to anyone of any age who loves Seuss characters, including Cat in the Hat, Horton the Elephant, and Yertle the Turtle. Kids love the show because it's colorful and filled with fun characters and lots of music. But it's not just for kids. Adults appreciate the complexity and depth of the characters and the language. These are fully realized characters too, the director said. The story follows Horton the Elephant, who longs for friendship and adventure. He discovers Whoville on a speck of dust and decides he must protect them by sitting on the egg, while also convincing other animals in the jungle of Newell that Whos and Whoville really do exist. Batterson, who will be a senior at Cedar Falls High School, described the show as a wild ride. When I first read the script, it was like, okay, there's a lot going on here, because it follows Horton's story and mixes in other pieces and characters from other Dr. Seuss books. There are 30 cast members acting, singing, and dancing and bringing Dr. Seuss' imaginary world to life. Most of the cast plays two or three characters. Addie Brennan portrays Yertle, while Andrew Gertz is the Grinch. Megan Willock is the boy Jojo. Erin McRae is Gertrude McFuzz. And Caleb Rivera plays Horton the Elephant. I'm big on relationships when I cast a show. I look at the dynamics between the actors and how well they play with each other, whether they're willing to take risk or not with their characters. Usually, everything falls into place, Weber explained. We're lucky to have a good pool of talent to draw from and really solid cast to pull it off. We also have the Bird Girls, seven girls who act as a Greek chorus and probably get the most stage time and have the most vocal responsibilities of anyone in the show. In addition to directing, Weber serves as the show's scenic designer and costume designer. I've wanted to do this show for years, he said. I'm doing a little more representational staging for the show, and that works well on this stage. Overscaled books are stacked to make curving staircases that lead to platforms that the performances, for example. Musically, the show is challenging and will be performed to pre-recorded tracks. Songs include Oh, the Things You Can Think, Horton Hears a Who, How Lucky You Are, Horton Sits on an Egg, and Green Eggs and Ham. Rosemary Gast is music and vocal director, and choreographer is Rachel Kuhner. Tickets are $30 for adults, $10 for students. They can be purchased at the box office Monday through Friday from 1 to 4, or before a show online at www.mycfct.org or by calling 319-277-5283. Well, break a leg to the cast of Seussical the Musical. Good luck. Our next Cedar Valley news story, the headline reads, Higher Cost Hit Cedar Falls on Construction Bids, by journalist Andy Malone. Cedar Falls. Monday marked the third time in the last 4 months that one of the City of Cedar Falls' massive infrastructure projects greatly exceeded its engineer's estimate for construction. Rhinebeck-based Peterson Contractors, Incorporated was awarded a $2,699,537 construction contract for the removal of bridge on Olive Street and the expansion of adjacent Peterson Plaza on College Street by extending the box culvert to Olive Street. It was the only bidder for what the engineer had estimated would cost $2,379,537 $205,932, or nearly $500,000 less. The contract amounted to 22% higher than the estimate. The City Council's latest contract approval comes in light of material costs being 25 to 40% higher than they were toward the beginning of this calendar year due to inflation, said Public Work Director Chase Schrage. City officials in a memo also pointed to material availability, shortages, and contractor work demand leading to increased cost. Schrage told the Courier that it may need to look at pushing projects scheduled later in the city's capital improvement plan, like in fiscal year of 2026, further down the road. As of now, he said the city wasn't thinking about postponing any notable projects in the near term. The City Center Street project from Clare Street to West Lone Tree came in at a cost that outpaced the estimate even more. A contract for those streetscape improvements totaling $1,540,597 was awarded to Cedar Falls-based Owen Contracting, the lone bidder. That was more than $400,000 above the $1,130,649 estimate, or about 36% higher. New curb and gutters, as well as sidewalks, Americans with Disabilities Act compliant pedestrian ramps, and landscaping will be part of the package. The gravel shoulders also will be removed. Rhinebeck-based Peterson Contractors Incorporated was the winner in May of another contract for reconstruction of West 27th Street from Hudson Road to the western property line of the new high school, currently under construction. It was also above the estimate, but by a much smaller margin. That project had an estimated cost of $7,291,651. Peterson Contractors was one of two bidders, with its $7,584,450 pitch coming in lowest. That is almost $300,000 above the estimate, or 4% higher. Three roundabouts, with two serving as entrances to the new high school, and a new traffic sign with additional turn lanes at the intersection of Hudson Road of West 27th Street are being constructed. Before that, the council approved another major construction contract in March that was even closer to the engineering estimate but still exceeded it. That was for its annual street program involving six streets this year. The contract awarded was for $3,266,189 versus the engineer's estimate of $3,180,122, a difference of $86,000, or less than 3%. All right, next in Cedar Valley News, community meeting planned on bond vote. Hudson School sets three events to explain need. Hudson. The Hudson Community School District will host a series of upcoming meetings ahead of the September 13th bond referendum. Community leaders will be able to hear about the district's facility needs, the process the district used to find a proposed solution, and the bond question on the ballot. Attendees will also learn about how the projects would address building safety and security, space needs, aging building systems, and the district's enrollment growth. The events will take place August 10th, 7 to 8 p.m. at St. Timothy Lutheran Church, August 16th, noon to 1 at Hudson High School Library, August 22nd, 7 to 8 p.m. at the Hudson High School Library. Throughout this process, we have engaged our community in a number of ways to help us examine our most pressing high school facility needs and develop potential solutions. This led to the bond question voters will consider on September 13th. Superintendent Tony Voss said in a news release, Now we look to continue this engagement through our upcoming community meetings. We encourage all district residents to take part in these important conversations about the future of our schools and the students we serve. In addition to the bond issue, residents will also vote on a proposed renewal of the physical plant and equipment levy and a revenue purpose statement on September 13th. If approved, the bond issue would allow the district to move forward on a series of projects at the high school, such as updating the building system and aging infrastructure, converting underused space into classrooms, creating a secure main entrance, rebuilding career and technical education labs, and adding gym space. An approval bond would have a property tax impact of $2.70 on every $1,000 of assessed property value. The owner of a home with an assessed value of $100,000 would see a tax impact of $133.06 per year, or $11.09 per month. The impact on 100 acres of agriculture land would be $358.93 per year, or $29.91 per month. There will be a satellite voting opportunity 4 to 9 p.m. September 2nd in the Hudson School Competition Gym. All registered voters may cast their ballots early during this time. All right, listeners, you are listening to the reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls paper, The Courier, for Thursday, August 4th, 2022, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Gilbert Hansen, 63, passed away peacefully at his home Friday, June 24th, in Waterloo. Gilbert was born in California. He moved to Waterloo area in 2004 and worked for John Deere, where he was planning to retire after 18 years of loyal service. Gilbert devoted his spare time to taking care of his family. He went above and beyond for his loved ones, and those closest to Gilbert witnessed him show the same compassion to anyone in need. Gilbert was deeply loved by his family and friends and will be greatly missed. Gilbert is survived by his son, Matthew Hansen, of Houston, Texas, and his four daughters, Tabitha Hansen of Cedar Falls, Sarah Kennedy of Houston, Texas, Amy James Kearns of Houston, Texas, Michael Hansen of Cedar Rapids, and several loving siblings, grandchildren, nieces, and nephews. He was preceded in death by his mother, Joanne Crawford, his sister, Rhonda Carahan, his son, Jake Hansen, and many other cherished loved ones. A celebration of life will be held Sunday, August 14th at 4 p.m. at Cedar Valley Arboretum and Botanic Gardens in Waterloo, with dinner to follow. Those wishing to attend are asked to please RSVP at gilbertsmemorial@gmail.com. Next, we have Larry Earl McGrain, 78, of Waterloo, died Sunday, July 31st, at Mercy One Medical Center. He was born May 27, 1944, in Waterloo, the son of Henry Adrian and Irma Toll McGrain. He married Diane Della Gridell on June 19, 1976, at Immaculate Conception Catholic Church in Gilbertville. Larry graduated from Columbus High School in 1962 and served in the Iowa National Guard. He was also a fourth degree Knights of Columbus member. He was employed with the Department of Transportation as a construction technician for 36 years. Larry was a league bowler and worked with Bowl for Kids' Sake for many years. He enjoyed watching golf and baseball on TV. Survivors include his wife, Diane of Waterloo, his children, Miranda, and spouse, Jason Ahrens of Cedar Rapids, Larry and partner, Regina McGrain of Oklahoma, a granddaughter, Ariel Ahrens, his brothers, Bill and partner, Margaret McGrain of Waterloo, Terry and partner, Mickey McGrain of Cedar Falls, Rich and partner Nancy McGrain of Cedar Falls, Pat McGrain of Waterloo, his sisters, Joan Craig of Waterloo, Barb and her partner Jim Reedy of Waterloo, Mary Jane Jim Osgood of Waterloo, and Linda and Mike Watson of Waterloo, his sister-in-law, Joellen McGrain of Des Moines, and several nieces and nephews. He is preceded in death by his parents, his brother, Tom McGrain, his brother-in-law, Bob Craig, and John Harvey, his niece, Kara McGrain. Mass of Christian burial will be at 11 a.m. Tuesday, August 9th, at Queen of Peace Catholic Church, with burial in Mount Olive Cemetery. Full military rites will be conducted by the Evansdale AMVETS Post 31, assisted by the Iowa Army Honor Guard. Public visitation will be from 4 to 8 p.m. Monday, August 8th, at Hagerty Wyckoff Garup Funeral Services on South Street, where there will be a 4 p.m. Fourth Degree Knights of Columbus Rosary. Visitation also 1 hour prior to services on Tuesday at the church. The Mass will be live streamed on the parish website, www.queenofpeaceparish.net. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to Columbus Catholic High School. Online condolences may be left at www.hagertywyckoffgarup.com. Rex Wood, 61, of Cloquet, Minnesota, passed away of complications from diabetes. He was surrounded by his loving family on Sunday, July 31, 2022. Funeral services will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, August 6, 2022, at the United Methodist Church, with lay servant William O'Brien officiating. Burial will be at the Greenwood Cemetery in Nashua. Visitation will precede services at the church on Saturday starting at 10 a.m. Rex was born September 14, 1960 in Waterloo, Iowa, to Russ and Phyllis Wood. His early years were spent in Sumner, Iowa. On August 7, 1980 in Cedar Falls, Rex married Rebecca Olson. They had 4 children, Ryan, Amanda, Andrea, and Rihanna. Rex worked construction as a carpenter, building bridges as a scaffolder and concrete construction. Later, he became a millwright, switching from the Carpenters Union to millwright in 1348 in Virginia, Minnesota. Rex enjoyed fishing, spending time with his friends and family. He was preceded in death by his parents, Ross Jr., Phyllis Murfield, son Ryan Wood, and brother Leslie Wood. Rex is survived by his wife, Rebecca of Cloquet, Minnesota, daughters Amanda and Daniel Linder of Minneapolis, Andrew and partner Matthew Perani of Esco, Minnesota, Rihanna and Sean McDonald of Superior, Wisconsin, a sister, Linda McHone of Sumner, Iowa, and a brother, Larry and Chris Wood of Sumner, Iowa. Rex enjoyed spending time with his 9 grandchildren. All right, listeners, we have some time to hear some sports news. MLB's Field of Dreams game is a week away. How exciting for Iowa. Reds, Farmer, Cubs, Swindle excited to participate in event by journalist Jim Nelson, Courier Sports Editor. When Cincinnati Reds shortstop Kyle Farmer was in high school, he had to write a report for a class. Admittedly not the biggest academic, Farmer chose a subject he was most familiar with, baseball. His topic? Shoeless Joe Jackson. In 7 days, Farmer will link his name to the movie site that immortalized Jackson. Wednesday, the 6-year MLB veteran appeared along with Chicago Cubs first baseman Frank Schwindel, MLB Network's Harold Reynolds, and other MLB representatives on a Zoom call with media to promote next Thursday's Field of Dreams game in Dyersville, featuring the Reds and the Cubs. Farmer is excited to be part of the second version of the game. Last year, the event featuring the New York Yankees and Chicago White Sox was named the Sports Event of the Year by Sports Business Journal. "I grew up watching it," Farmer said of the movie Field of Dreams. "It was on TV 2 nights ago and I watched the whole thing. It is an awesome movie and I'm looking forward to getting out there." Both players said they watched the game last year and can't wait to not only put on a good show for fans of baseball, but actually experience the event themselves. "It's a great opportunity to play this game, and it's going to be a lot of fun," said Schwindel, who has spent parts of the last 2 seasons playing for the Iowa Cubs, Chicago's AAA farm team, before entrenching himself at first for the major league club. "I'm excited for the opportunity. Walk through the corn, sit on that iconic bench. Oh, we just are going to soak it all in and have as much fun as we can." Among the things Farmer is excited about is the Reds will be wearing replicas of Cincinnati's 1919 uniform and being out on the field and watching the guys operate the manual scoreboard. "I thought it was pretty cool watching them come out of the corn, seeing Aaron Judge walk out. It was pretty cool watching that," Farmer said of last year's broadcast. "Watching Tim Anderson hit that walk-off was pretty special." Schwindel echoed Farmer's comments. "The field looked unbelievable," Schwindel said. "Watching the homers go out onto the corn was great." As for he and the Cincinnati experience, Farmer said the only thing different is the location. "The objection, like every game, is to win." Well, I hope you can take yourself out to the ball game next week and enjoy the game. Else in baseball news, Dodger legend Scully dies at 94. Broadcaster spent 67 years with the Dodgers. By Beth Harris, AP sports writer. Los Angeles Hall of Famer broadcaster Vin Scully, whose tones provided the soundtrack of summer while entertaining and informing Dodger fans in Brooklyn and Los Angeles for 67 years, died Tuesday night. He was 94. Scully died at his home in the Hidden Hills neighborhood of Los Angeles, the team announced after being informed by family members. No cause of death was provided. "He was the best there ever was," pitcher Clayton Kershaw said after the Dodgers game in San Francisco. "Just a special man. I'm grateful and thankful I got to know him as well as I did." As for the longest tenured broadcaster with a single game in pro history, Scully saw it all and called it all. He began in the 1950 eras of Pee Wee Reese and Jackie Robinson, on to the 1960s with Don Drysdale and Sandy Koufax, and the 70s with Steve Garvey and Don Sutton. Through the 80s was Orville Hershel and Fernando Valdez. In the 90s, it was Mike Piazza and Hondo Noma, followed by Kershaw, Manny Ramirez, and Yasiel Puig in the 21st century. "You gave me my wild horse name, you gave me my love, you hugged me like a father," tweeted Puig, the talented Cuban-born outfielder who burned brightly upon his Dodger debut in 2013. "I will never forget you. My heart is broken." The Dodgers changed players, managers, executives, owners, and even coast, but Scully with his soothing, insightful style, remained a constant for the fans. He opened broadcasts with the familiar greeting, "Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant good evening to you wherever you may be." Ever gracious, both in person and on the air, Scully considered himself merely a conduit between the game and the fans. His voice played a memorable role in some of the greatest moments in the history of our sport, Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred said. "I am proud that Vin was synonymous with baseball because he embodied the very best of our national pastime." Story continues on to the next page. After the Dodgers' 9-5 win, the Giants posted a Scully tribute on the video board. There's not a better storyteller, and I think everyone considers him family, Dodgers manager Dave Roberts said. He was in our living rooms for many generations. He lived a fantastic life, a legacy that will live on forever. Although he was paid by the Dodgers, Scully was unafraid to criticize a bad play or a manager's decision, or praise an opponent while spinning stories against a backdrop of routine plays and noteworthy achievements. He always said he wanted to see things with his eyes, not his heart. We have lost an icon, team president and CEO Stan Kasten said. His voice will always be heard and etched in all our minds forever. Vince Edward Scully was born November 29, 1927, in the Bronx. He was the son of a silk salesman who died of pneumonia when Scully was 7. His mother moved the family to Brooklyn, where the red-haired, blue-eyed Scully grew up playing stickball in the streets. As a child, Scully would grab a pillow, put it under the family's four-legged radio, and play his head directly under the speaker to hear whatever college football game was on the air. With a snack of saltine crackers and a glass of milk nearby, the boy was transfixed by the crowd's roar and the raised goosebumps. He thought he'd like to call the action himself. Scully, who played outfield for 2 years on the Fordham University baseball team, began his career by working baseball, football, and basketball games for the university's radio station. At the age of 22, he was hired by CBS radio affiliate in Washington, D.C. He soon joined Hall of Famer Red Barber and Connie Desmond in the Brooklyn Dodgers radio and television booths. In 1953, at the age of 25, Scully became the youngest person to broadcast a World Series game, a mark that still stands today. He moved west with the Dodgers in 1958. Scully called three perfect games, Don Larsen in the 1956 World Series, Sandy Koufax in 1965, and Dennis Martinez in 1991, and 18 no-hitters. He also was on the air when Don Drysdale set his scoreless inning streak of 58 and two-thirds inning in 1968, and again when Hershers broke the record with 59 consecutive scoreless innings 20 years later. When Hank Aaron hit his 715th home run to break Babe Ruth's record in 1974, it was against the Dodgers, and of course, Scully called it. A black man is getting a standing ovation in the Deep South for breaking a record for an all-time baseball icon, Scully told listeners. What a marvelous moment for baseball. Scully credited the birth of transistor radio as the greatest single break of his career. Fans had trouble recognizing the lesser players during the Dodgers' first 4 years in the vast Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum. There were 70 or so odd rows away from the action, he said in 2016. They brought the radio in to find out about all the other players and to see what they were trying to see downfield. All right. And the story is accompanied by a picture of Scully. Caption reads, Vin Scully works in his booth at Dodger Stadium in Los Angeles, 2010 of August 22nd. All right. I think we have time for one more news story from the Cedar Valley. August 14th, final day of season for Waverly Pool. Courier staff report. Waverly. August 14th is the last day of the municipal outdoor swimming pool will be open this season. A lack of available staffing after that date is driving the decision, said Leisure Service Director Garrett Rigdon. That final day, the pool at 601 Fifth Avenue Southwest will be open for the regular hours from 1 to 7. As we finish up another great season at the Waverly Pool, we would like to thank all the patrons that came out to enjoy the water with us this summer. The pool is closing around the same time as past years and is not expected to open for any special exceptions or events beyond August 14th. Last year, the final day was August 5th, according to Facebook. Rigdon said the latest the pool has ever been open in the last 10 years is the 18th or 19th. That first week of August is typical when we lose a lot of people. Management has talked about creating certain incentives to keep seasonal employees there through August and up until that first week of school. But, Rigdon said, the reality is they'd rather do other things than work. And he doesn't blame them because they're typically taking off to go to sports or band camp or family vacation or one of the final weeks of summer. The pool opened May 28th this season. Next in Cedar Valley News, UNI alum to be next leader of Hy-Vee by Courier staff. Cedar Falls. The University of Northern Iowa alum Aaron Wise has been named Hy-Vee's next chief executive officer, effective on October 1st. The Cherokee native studied political science at UNI, according to a news release from the university. He began his Hy-Vee career while still a student there in 1993. Wise is currently vice chairman of the Hy-Vee Incorporated and president of the company's supply chain and subsidiaries. Chairman and CEO Randy Etker recently announced his promotion. Wise will continue to work to Etker, who will stay as Hy-Vee's chairman of the board. Aaron is ready to help me lead the company as chief executive officer, Etker said in a news release. He has a strong vision for the total breadth of our company and extremely knowledgeable in many areas. With Aaron as CEO, Hy-Vee continues to be positioned for incredible growth and innovation. After leaving UNI, Wise held various operations leadership roles before joining Hy-Vee's executive staff as Director of Real Estate Strategic Planning in 2012. Over the next decade, Wise continued to rise through the ranks of Hy-Vee and, most notably, made a tremendous impact on Hy-Vee's health and wellness division. In December 2020, he was promoted to the executive vice president level and became president of digital growth and co-chief operating officer just a few months later. He has held the current position since December of 2021. Congratulations. Hudson Man wins $25,000 a year for life by journalist Maria Kuiper. Clive. A Hudson man claimed his winnings from the Big Lucky for Life drawing, in which he won $25,000 per year for life. Joe Kampman, age 67, is the latest person to win the Iowa lottery game. Kampman decided to take the lump sum of $390,000. He owns an engineering consulting firm. He said he will spend his winnings on paying off debt, investing, and maybe buying a hot tub. He bought his ticket at the Get and Go on 124th Wood Street in Hudson for the July 24th drawing. The store will also receive a $500 bonus for selling the winning ticket. Kopman's daughter and son-in-law reached out to him before he announced he was the big winner, seeing news articles that the winning ticket being sold in Hudson. He says, "Does this mean you won?" Kopman recalled. "I told my wife to text back. They figured it out." Kaufman is Iowa's 15th winner since the game started in January of 2016. He's the second person to win this summer. Doug Schluckman of Davenport won on June 27th. The game is $2 with drawings each night. The game's top prizes are described as lasting as long as you do. The minimum guarantee payout is 20 years with a lump sum option. The ticket matched all five numbers but did not match the lucky ball. Matching all six numbers gives you $1,000 a day for life. The winning numbers, 11, 27, 37, 38, and 48, and the lucky ball, 16. Kaufman gave a tongue-in-cheek answer when asked why he plays the lottery. "The chances of winning something increase in your favor when you buy a ticket," he said. Congratulations to Kaufman. And that does it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls paper for Thursday, August 4th, 2022. I'm your reader, Mary Dove. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website at iowaradioreading.org anytime. Thanks for listening.
I'm getting older. Do I need to worry about falling?
Yes, you do. Every year, 1 in 4 people 65 and older will experience a fall, and many result in serious injury. The majority of falls happen at home, so take a look around. Replace bulbs and add lighting to help you see obstacles. Remove things that can make you trip. Fix uneven steps and floors, and install handrails in bathrooms and on stairs. Consider balance or strength training exercises, which can help with agility. Get your eyes and hearing checked regularly. Changes in your hearing can affect your balance. To learn more, please talk to your doctor about steps you can take to help prevent a fall. You can also visit aarpfoundation.org or medicaremadeclear.com/falls. This message was brought to you by United Healthcare and AARP Foundation.